of the Savak, the secret police. Another instance referred to in English as Black Friday was at Jaleh Square, now named Martyr Square, where the Shah's troops gunned down hundreds of protesters. It would only be a matter of months in January of 1979 until the Shah would leave Iran like a coward, pretending that he was going on vacation. He actually never returned. He stayed there in exile until his death. Shortly thereafter, Imam Khomeini finally returned to Iran on February 1st of 1979, greeted by jubilant crowds after spending 15 years in exile. In fact, over a million Iranians flocked to the streets in a show of support. Widely regarded as both the spiritual and the de facto leader of the revolution, an Islamic Republic was established through a national referendum and the adoption of a constitution under Imam Khomeini as Iran's first leader. And this marked the beginning of a whole new era for the nation. Finally, after decades of rule under a Western-backed puppet sponsored by the US and the UK, Iranians had now finally reclaimed their country by taking to the streets in the millions, voting in a new constitution and establishing a new Islamic Republic. And of course, with that said, Iranians, of course, regained sovereignty not just over their nation, but also over their natural resources, including the oil, which the British had plundered for so long. So, again, when we talk about the Islamic Revolution of 1979, it's really important to also talk about the history behind it, about the role that the United States and the United Kingdom played in the coups in 1953 by installing the Shah, who betrayed his country's riches to these multinational corporations and brutally repressed the Iranian people. This is a very, very important part of history that many Americans and many British do not understand, let alone know of. They have hardly any clue of the atrocities, the countless coups, interventions, the meddling, and all of the nefarious covert operations that their governments carry out all across the world in their names. From their point of view, Iranian history starts in 1979, and that's all they know, and it's completely awash with anti-Oriental propaganda which seeks to demonize Iran. The truth is that Iran's revolution represented a landmark moment, the awakening of a movement, and the will of the people to fight and regain their sovereignty from the West. This caused a huge upset for Western governments and the multinationals that run them behind the scenes. In reality, Britain and the United States don't want other countries to be democracies. They want other countries that they can control, both politically and economically. Only then are those countries considered allies. You know, when nations like Iran, who are not only resource-rich, but rich in culture and history, actually stand up for themselves, it is extremely embarrassing for the suits in Whitehall and Capitol Hill who think that they are above everyone else. Iran's Islamic Revolution wasn't just an upheaval of Iran's political climate, it was also an act of defiance and an act of anti-imperialism. This idea of standing up to oppressors is something that is very deeply ingrained in Iran's culture, and this is not just something we see internally, but also internationally. Iran has been an ally and helped to liberate my country of Syria from the various jihadist groups and the scourge of foreign terrorists that once again Britain and the United States have financed along with Saudi Arabia and others. And equally, since the revolution, Iran has helped Lebanon and Palestine in their resistance against the Zionist occupation and in the protection of their lands. And more recently, we see in Iraq and Venezuela how Iran has helped these nations stand up against foreign invaders and imperialism. This is very important for people to understand, and it also explains why the West has held a grudge against Iran ever since it broke free from Occidental rule, seeking to cripple it always with sanctions, with war, with intimidation. Now, not just because Iranians took back control of their country, but also because they outmaneuver and help other resistant movements regionally and globally, and help other people stand up for themselves. Sure, there's no such thing as a perfect country or a perfect political system in the world, but there is something to be said about a nation and a people that are brave enough to stand up to tyranny, to colonization, to white supremacy, and then help their brothers and sisters elsewhere to do the same. It is a remarkable feat of resistance and anti-imperialism, and why Iran continues to be a thorn in the side of those oppressors who seek to colonize the Middle East. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The first first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagir.
People who believed in the Prophet, except for a few, leave aside the Ahlul Bayt themselves, as according to this ziyarah, their status is something, because this ziyarah doesn't talk about their material status, their material blessings or presence on earth too much, although it addresses that as well. What it speaks of, and there's less of this prior to this time, is the spiritual status of the Ahlul Bayt. The Prophet showed miracles. It was evident, obviously. A person who feeds a gathering of people with a small amount of food that does not come short. And when you look at the amount of food that's there, it should come short. It shouldn't be enough for the people that are here. They come, they all eat. All they want, there's still more left. They see that. They see, they are there with the Prophet, that particular individual, in the cave. They trace the Prophet from Mecca all the way to the entrance of this cave, and they couldn't trace him those couple of steps inside the cave. Isn't this a miracle? Doesn't this tell you that this man is not an ordinary human being? There's a connection he has with Allah that's different. And all the other miracles, the Quran is the greatest miracle that we have trouble understanding. It's sitting on those shelves over there. None of us really understand what's in there. We just think, okay, this is a great book. The normal, the more tangible forms of miracles, mu'jizat, people saw. Yet they had trouble. After 23 years of the presence of the Prophet, when the Prophet went for Hajjatul Wida', he introduced something that was not known to the Arabs, a ritual regarding Hajj and Umrah. Hajj and Umrah were not alien to the Arab population. The Arabs already had them. From whom? From Prophet Ibrahim, the one who founded that, whatever was left of that civilization, Prophet Ismail. They performed Hajj. They set up the Kaaba, they performed Hajj. They showed people how to do it, the season of it, the month of the year, how Hajj is done, how Umrah is done. There were two forms of Hajj that were already being performed. Hajjul Ifrad and Qiran. One is a Hajj that you don't have a sacrifice with you, and Qiran is the one that you carry a sacrifice along with you to Hajj. And it's only Hajj. For those who've been to Hajj, they know there's the first part. Usually when we go for Hajj, the first part of the A'mal is called Umrah, Umratul Tamattu. The Hajj that we perform is that we call Hajjul Tamattu. It's a combination of Hajj and Umrah. Prior to the 23rd year of the presence of the Prophet amongst the people, there was no such thing. Even in Islam, the Muslims that went for Hajj, before they left Mecca to Medina, and then after the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, and after the conquest of Mecca, when they performed Hajj, they performed the forms of Hajj that they were familiar with. The Prophet didn't say it's different. In fact, they were told it's the same. They did Umrah. When they went for, they left Medina and they ended up signing the treaty known as the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. They had actually headed out towards Mecca for an Umrah. An Umrah that everybody was familiar with. These were practices that were already there. Hajj al-Tamattu' was not something that was known to the Arabs. The Muslims up to that point, they don't. The Prophet, after they do the first few things, when they arrived with Ihram into Mecca, they went and performed tawaf, and then sa'i. They did the prayers. The Prophet told those who had not carried their sacrifice with them, he himself had carried, he brought 100 camels from Medina for the sacrifice of Hajj. He said, those who didn't bring, like Fatima al-Zahra, salamullahi alayha, she didn't carry a sacrifice. Amir al-Mu'mineen, he was not with the Prophet. He came from Yemen. When he made Ihram, before getting to Mecca, he said, oh Allah, I make the intention that my Hajj is the same as the Prophet's Hajj, whatever his intention is. He arrived, the Prophet told him of the situation, and Amir al-Mu'mineen told him what intention he had made. The Prophet said, okay, your Hajj is like mine. 36 of these camels are yours, sacrificed for you. The rest of them are a sacrifice for myself. Anyone who has not carried a sacrifice, they need to do taqsir, cut a little bit of their nails or their hair. And then at that point, they become muhil. They are no longer in the state of ihram. Well, the Prophet mentioned this. I'll get this whole story is for this. 23 years, the Prophet has asked people to come. This is Hajjatul Wida'. He says, God has informed me those who have not carried a sacrifice with them, they need to become muhil, that is umrah. Then in a few days before the 9th of Dhul-Hijjah, they're going to become muhram again and they'll start the a'mal of hajj. A person that was with the Prophet all these years, I don't need to mention his name, that's not important who it is. The very fact, and he's not the only one, he's the one that had the audacity to say this. He stands before all these people, he says, Muhammad, is this from God or is it from you? Objecting to this. Is that a question? After 23 years, you still have that question? You still haven't realized, وَمَا يَنْطِقُ بِالْهَوَىٰ إِنْ هُوَ إِلَّا وَحْيٌ يُوحَىٰ. Whatever comes out of the mouth of the Prophet is from Allah. You're asking, is this from you or from God? God told the Prophet, I want you to add 2 extra rak'ah to Dhuhr and Asr and Isha prayers. I make 2 rak'ah prayers. This is how we have plenty of ahadith. This is very clear. Allah made 2 rak'ah wajib for each of Fajr was 2 rak'ah. Dhuhr is 2 rak'ah, Asr is 2 rak'ah, Maghrib is 2 rak'ah, Isha is 2 rak'ah. Then God tells, I want you to add 2 rak'ah. The Prophet adds 2 rak'ah to the prayer. This is the status of the Prophet. Yet what happens, this is the status of the people regarding the Prophet. And you know the story regarding Amir al-Mu'mineen. أول مظلوم. No, you saw how we just very briefly, and I can't really get it across entirely, of how the community that has already believed in the Prophet sees him. How far they are, the Muslims are, from understanding who the Prophet actually is. When the Prophet passed away, they didn't see Ali ibn Abi Talib as even the way they saw the Prophet. That was still way below the status of the Prophet. They didn't see Ali ibn Abi Talib even at that level. And so you see what happened. Imam al-Mujtaba, you hear the stories. Imam al-Husayn. Imam Zayn al-Abidin. From Imam Zayn al-Abidin's time, they start training students. They almost start from scratch. There's a hadith that says Imam Zain al-Abidin started when there's only 3 believers at his time. One of them is Abu Khalid al-Kabuli. When you look at the story of Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, he actually arrives in Medina. He's from Kabul, that's why he's called Kabuli. Abu Khalid al-Kabuli, he arrives in Medina. He goes to the Ahlul Bayt. Who does he end up with? He ends up with Muhammad ibn al-Hanafiyya after Karbala. This is after Ashura. He ends up with the brother of Imam al-Husayn, the uncle of Imam Zain al-Abidin. He spends years with this man, thinking that he's the Imam. Eventually he comes to know he's not. And he goes to Imam Zain al-Abidin. Imam Zain al-Abidin trains him. A couple of others as well. There's 3 names that have been mentioned as people who believed in the Ahlul Bayt, they started building the Shia, the real Shia, the ones that saw the Ahlul Bayt as people that they need to listen to, muftaradu ta'a, we need to obey whatever they say. They started creating students, teaching them about Islam. One of the important factors in Islam is that, as difficult as it is, that's very difficult for an imam who has tawadu, for an imam who doesn't see themselves as anything, to tell the student of theirs that this is my status with Allah. That's very difficult for us to get. Anyhow, they teach them, those who are more ready. But still a lot of, even the Shia of the Ahlul Bayt have trouble understanding the status of the Ahlul Bayt. Up to today, we have that problem.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. We have all heard the famous saying, survival of the fittest, right? And when we talk about survival of the fittest, it is usually associated with being ruthless, with being selfish, with, you know, minding your own business, not getting distracted by life's drama, even if it means, you know, helping other people out, taking time out of your day, sacrificing your energy and your time and your work or whatever to help improve other people's lives and situations. Survival of the fittest means that it's a dog-eat-dog kind of world and this and that. But even Darwin himself believed, who, by the way, studied human evolution, believed that mankind is not naturally or biologically competitive or that self-centered as we might think he is. As a matter of fact, Darwin believed that we are profoundly social beings, that caring and being kind is what's innate and biological about us. We are such social beings that I was reading an article a while back talking about a hospital where their nursery had a section basically that would take care of abandoned newborns, and they would take in volunteers to come and just hold these newborns and have skin-to-skin contact with them during the first few weeks of those newborns, those infants' development, because otherwise there was the fear of the infants dying if they could not have that human contact. That's how social we are. Now, what does that have to do with kindness? Well, how about we listen to a short story on this matter and continue our discussion after that? Stay with us.
The hotel clerk who helped the couple. We have an interesting story for today. On a stormy night many years ago, an elderly man and his wife entered the lobby of a small hotel in Philadelphia, USA. The couple approached the front desk hoping to get some shelter for the night. "Could you possibly give us a room here?" the husband asked. The clerk, a friendly man, looked at the couple and explained that there were three conventions in town. "All of our rooms are taken," the clerk said. "But I can't send a nice couple like you out into the rain at night. Would you perhaps be willing to sleep in my room?" When the couple declined, the young man pressed on. "Don't worry about me. I'll make out just fine," the clerk told them. So the couple agreed. As he paid his bill the next morning, the elderly man said to the clerk, "You are the kind of manager who should be the boss of the best hotel. Maybe someday I'll build one for you." The clerk looked at them and smiled. 2 years passed. The clerk had almost forgotten the incident when he received a letter from the old man. He recalled that stormy night and enclosed a round-trip ticket to New York, asking the young man to pay them a visit. The old man met him in New York and led him to the corner of 5th Avenue and 34th Street. Then he pointed to a great new building there, with watchtowers thrusting up to the sky. "That," said the old man, "is the hotel I have just built for you to manage." "You must be joking," the young man said. "I can assure you I'm not," said the old man. The old man's name was William Waldorf Astor, and that structure was the original Waldorf Astoria Hotel. The young clerk who became its first manager was George C. Bolt. This young clerk never foresaw the turn of events that would lead him to become the top man of one of the world's most glamorous hotels.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
I was having a very interesting discussion with one of my friends, and they were saying that this kindness that we are constantly told, especially I don't know, maybe 2019, 2018 onwards, especially during 2020 because the world was, you know, being totally chaotic on steroids. This idea of being kind to myself can find its roots and source in the fact that Allah chooses to be kind toward me. If He wasn't kind toward me, He wouldn't provide me with so many blessings, not just materialistic, but the spiritual blessings that would help me find my way back to Him again. If He wasn't kind to me and if He didn't love me, He wouldn't give me that opportunity or that even acknowledgement that there is a truth beyond myself and that I need to better myself and try everything in my power to obtain that truth. So basically, and if we want to talk about the different ways of being kind, well, the ahadith and narrations from the Ahlul Bayt talk about this topic in numerous, almost countless occasions. Kindness could be an act of charity. Charity can be giving food, giving clothing, giving money to those who are in need. Charity could even be sharing a piece of knowledge with someone and increasing their wisdom and understanding of the world. Charity can be a simple smile that you give to someone that, you know, could shift their emotions and their focus from something perhaps negative that's going on inside them. Charity can be the time we spend with our loved ones, even our family members, that quality time we spend with our kids, our nieces, our nephews, the patience and tolerance we express and we display toward our neighbors. Because neighbors can be loud, they can leave their trash in front of the door, they can, you know, in a little plastic bag, not just toss their trash in front of the door, that'd be gross. They could, you know, forget to close, shut the gate or things like that. That level of tolerance that we have toward our neighbors can be an act of charity within itself, can be an act of kindness. It's recognized in religion as being an act of kindness. Also, one way to be kind is to be kind toward people's mental state. You know, the idea of checking up on someone, making sure that they're okay. We will always have that one friend, two friends that are always struggling with something if we happen to, you know it. Kindness would be to actively make it an objective to check up on that someone and reassuring them every once in a while that you are there for them if they should ever need it, that it's okay for them to reach out to you and ask you for help, and that you've made it a sort of purpose in your life to be available for these people. And nothing should be taken for granted. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said that a small act of kindness, even if it's a nickel or a dime or a dollar, is better than no kindness at all. So don't ever tell yourself but that, oh, this is so little, I'm so ashamed to be giving a dollar, or I'm so ashamed to be giving the other half of my sandwich. Don't ever say that. Think of the person who is evaluating your act of kindness and the fact that he is limitless and he looks at your intention, and if your intention is to please him with your small act, he will magnify it for you and he will give it to you, give it back to you tenfold. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. And when our verses are recited to them as clear evidences, you recognize in the faces of those who disbelieve disapproval. They are almost on the verge of assaulting those who recite to them our verses. Say, then shall I inform you of what is worse than that? It is the fire which Allah has promised those who disbelieve, and wretched is the destination.
Dear listeners, we are talking about the 72nd verse of the chapter. وَإِذَا تُتْلَى عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتُنَا بَيِّنَاتٍ تَعْرِفُ فِي وُجُوهِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا الْمُنْكَرُ. And when our clear signs are recited unto them, you recognize repugnance in the faces of those who disbelieve. يَكَادُونَ يَسْطُونَ بِالَّذِينَ يَتْلُونَ عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِنَا. So that well nigh they shall rush upon those who recite to them our signs. قُلْ أَفَأُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِشَرٍ مِّن ذَلِكُمْ. Say, shall I inform you of what is worse than this? النار, the fire, وعدها الله الذين كفروا. Allah has promised it to those who disbelieve. وبئس المصير, and an evil destination it is. In the previous program, we concluded that it is usually common when in conflict between the paganism and faith, that the pagans concentrate their harsh attacks and invasions upon the centers, spiritual centers and personalities of the people of faith. So they try to destroy the personalities, not only personalities, but the temples and centers of worship. And they attack the preachers and the audience of the religion sometimes as well. So these pagans are always having a state of deniance. إِذَا تُتْلَى تَعْرِفُ فِي وُجُوهِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا الْمُنْكَرُ. Whenever it is recited unto them, You can feel, you can see in the faces of those who have disbelieved this state of denyance, this repugnance, this state of dislike and disgust. But the Almighty Allah says, "Tutla alayhim," even though we know and we already know that they will deny these verses, but tutla alayhim, because the Almighty Allah is doing itmamul hujjah with them. And not only that, but this ayatuna bayinat, the verse says, this reasoning and the statements that are presented unto them are really clear. But since these people of deniance do not have any proof, and their ideas are not based on any kind of logic, the only chance they have, the only opportunity they have, is to attack the people reciting these verses. So resorting to physical power is the sign of inability in bringing the logic and truth.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
The Quranic phrase yakaduna yastuna is formed by two simple verbs in future tense, which in Arabic work as the constancy of the action. And here, these two verbs altogether, yakaduna yastuna, they denote the existence of status of rushing in them. And sometimes the circumstances require that they would practically make it appear. But when the circumstances did not allow, often the feeling of readiness for attack is always recognizable in their faces. And they always display signs of uneasiness. And this proves that they could not rush and beat. But you can feel in their faces. تَعْرِفُ فِي وُجُوهِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُ الْمُنْكَرُ, the verse says. But for these illogical people, the Quran commands the Holy Prophet ﷺ to do as follows. Say, shall I inform you of what is worse than this? قُلْ أَفَأُنَبِّئُكُمْ بِشَرٍ مِّن ذَلِكُمْ. And this means that if you think that these clear verses are some evils, since they do not agree with your wrong and deviated thoughts, I may introduce worse than them, which is the divine painful punishment. النَّارُ وَعَدَهَا اللَّهُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا. The fire, Allah has promised it to those who disbelieve. And this painful punishment will finally encompass you for this obstinacy and enmity of yours. It is the same blazing fire that Allah has promised to disbelievers. The holy verse says, "An-naru 'adaha Allah alladhina kafaru." The fire Allah has promised it to those who disbelieve. and the blazing fire of hell is the worst abode. The verse concludes, وَبِئْسَ الْمَصِيرُ, and an evil destination it is. So in fact, there is no response save the hellfire for these rude people inside whom the flames of bigotry and obstinacy is always enlightened. As a fact, the divine chastisement is always close, appropriate to the quality of the same sin and disobedience that people commit in this world. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. You are listening to. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. We want to talk about Iran's developments since 1979 in different fields and on different aspects. Brother Ali Alavian, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam, and thank you for having me here.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So, since the occurrence of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, 1979, about 42 years have passed, and in these, we can say 42 years, different achievements and developments were made by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about some of the developments that have been made after the 1979 Islamic Revolution of Iran, especially in the field of military developments, and then we can say defending national integrity of the country. Brother Ali Alavian, let's start with you. The military power of Iran and having, we can say, organized army has also existed before. We can say the Islamic Revolution of Iran. We know that the king and the monarchical system is famous for having an army, okay? It is a king, it must have an army. But after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, we saw a different type of spirit among the revolutionary guards and the, we can say, defenders of the borders of Iran. We could see one good example in the Iraqi imposed war on Iran for 8 years, that we could see the young commanders and the young generation of the society who were very much active in defending the land. And I think it started over there, trusting on the young generation in order to give them the strategic planning and the military planning of a society, especially in Iran. So what's your comparison on that? What's your take on that, brother?
Yeah, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Over the past four decades, the world of istikbar and the world of arrogance has tried to make lots of schemes and conspiracies against the Iranian revolution. Starting from the imposed 8-year war by Iraq and defending Iraq, and actually the reaction of the Iranian army was heroic, actually. That's and right. They stood, alhamdulillah, in front of them. But we have seen that how weak we were in some aspects with regard to the military equipments that we needed. And as, for example, it is quite famous in Iran that we even lacked barbed wire for our needs. And it was even said and actually reflected in the words of the leader of the Islamic Ummah. I said that we didn't have even the technology to make barbed wire. Also, last night it was very interesting that I was thinking about this show that we are going to be with you. I was listening to one of the military authorities in our country that he said also we could not even, the cameras that we had, we could not actually check the status of the enemy in the battlefield. We did not have these facilities to see and to check if this is, for example, an enemy or this is one of ours. I mean, to see, and the cameras that we had were too poor, too weak, that we did not have this power to distinguish between our troops and the troops of the enemy.
We were not ready for such a big war.
Definitely.
You know?
Okay. So, why? Because we have inherited lots of, let's say, military equipments from the Shah time.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were left and they actually, these equipments were left and the army generals left the country. So it were, all of them actually were at the hand of the revolutionary troops. But what is the reason that we had nothing, even in confrontation with Iraq, we didn't have anything? It means that, as you said, dictators actually try to buy whatever they need from outside, but they do not actually trust their own people to make these things. Now, look at Iranians in the electronic war. Are mm-hmm. they behind the actually the war, the development of the military equipments in the world,
mm-hmm.
or even in the technology of making drones and actually drone war?
The ballistic missiles.
The ballistic
missiles.
Okay. So we see the changes are, alhamdulillah, great. So it means that even in comparison to the previous previous government, that it was totally dependent on what has been given to them by mm-hmm. U.S. or European countries.
Yeah.
Now we reach to their self-independence in production of this technology, these equipments that we need for a war. That's why our security has increased, brother, not only in Iran, but outside, but even outside of the Iran. When Iraqis come and ask us for help to combat ISIS, look, it is not inside Iran. We are helping them outside of our borders.
Okay.
When, for example, Palestinians are in need of these missiles and the technology, mm-hmm. we actually export this technology to them. Correct. So it means that you have added the borders of your security outside of your country and geographical borders. And this is what Imam Ali alayhi salam says in says that it says, a good and wise person do not fight with his enemy in his home. It takes the battlefield of the battlefield of his war outside of his home. So this is what we reach to. Look, the borders of Iran with his enemy, with its enemies, is now beyond the south, beyond West Asia. Now, when we are actually testing our 2,000-kilometer ballistic missiles, it means, alhamdulillah, we have actually developed the border of our security, not only inside Iran, but outside of Iran, till 2,000 kilometers.
But according what your rahbar said, all our military devices and equipments are used in the defensive mode and not
Definitely.
The attack.
We
and not
have
the attack
never
mode,
started,
okay.
and we were not willing, and we were not
in a
meant
war position.
To start any war against anywhere, because even the story of primitive war is not a place, a right place to discuss it. It has a lengthy discussion, even in the scholarly gatherings. It needs to be discussed if we believe in it or no. So this is a complicated issue that we do not want to talk about.
Thank you very much, brother Ali Alavian. So Said Mohsen Naqvi, these military developments of Iran after the Islamic Revolution, we can say, has made it. And I think that one of the masterminds behind this development was Rahbar himself. We can say his emphasis on, empowering a society and empowering a government and having technological development that is yours, not the others. We know that most of the military equipments that are sold by the U.S. and the other countries to the Muslim lands or across the world we can say, have special red codes. If the red codes are not given, they cannot even use it, okay? They cannot even press a button. It means that the technological and the scientific knowledge is not theirs. But after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, we had some the scientists in Iran who could establish it themselves and who could invent such accessories and military equipments. As a non-Iranian, how do you find the military power of Iran outside the borders?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, first of all, I see a change in the system, the rest of the world and the Islamic revolution. And the change is that in Islam, when there is a divine leader or the leader, that is not a leader for the Muslim Ummah only, that is a leader for the whole world, for the whole universe. Because Quran and the religion, it belongs to everyone, not just specific, not to just specific people. The main difference between the what happened after the revolution, especially when Imam Khomeini did this revolution, and when he raised his voice, and after that we can see the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. The main difference is they have raised their voice for the oppressed people in the world. On top of that, obviously we know that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam in his life, he never had a war invading in his life. Even he had the defense. He had the wars, like he defended himself. And while he was defending himself, he was making Muslims like powerful. He was giving power to the Muslims, strengthening their power so that the enemies could not basically, we can say, like attack them. This was the main idea. We can see the same thing happening in the Islamic Revolution, that after Islamic Revolution, not only Iran did not invade any country, although it could, but also we have seen like it strengthens itself and it gives strength to its neighbor oppressed, we can say, nations. For example, the Palestinians, the Lebanese, we can see the Afghanis, or for example, the Yemenis right now.
Now the ISIS war, the Syrian and the Iraqis.
In Iraq and Syria, yes, yeah. We have seen ISIS war as well. So basically, what we see from outside, we see a country, an Islamic revolution, who is not just working for its own, but it's working for all the oppressed ones. And it is giving the courage to all those who are oppressed by different, we can say, like terrorist groups or the so-called governments. It is giving the power or encouragement to us to raise our voice against this oppression. And the way Islamic Republic has basically has achieved all these things, for example, from the, we can say, like the atomic energy that it has.
That's right.
The missiles and all those things that it has achieved by themselves, although being under the sanctions, it is a big achievement. Mm-hmm. Obviously, me being a Pakistani, for example, we have the atomic bomb, but obviously we also have the stick of America on top of us.
That's right. Do you have the atomic bomb or atomic energy?
We have atomic bomb.
Oh,
we
in
are
Pakistan,
the sixth
have.
Country, yeah.
Yeah,
and the India is the seventh. Obviously, we both have tested on each other.
Yes.
The atomic bombs, if you guys
really?
Remember,
wow,
in 1997,
man.
Maybe. So this was tested.
Yes.
So we are the first, we can say, the only Muslim country who has the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
The Pakistan Islamic Republic.
This is because of the presence of the scientists over there, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it was okay. Because of the presence of okay. the scientists, and obviously. What we can see in Iran that although having all those sanctions and all those barriers, the way Iran has protected himself and also giving power to, for example, the Syrians, the way we have seen recently how, like in 2006, how Hezbollah has defeated Israel.
Yes.
And Israel, we know that this regime, the Zionist
33-day
regime. 33-day
war.
33-day
yeah.
wars. How powerful was it?
Mm-hmm.
And those people with the ordinary, we can say, like the weapons, how they defeated them. After that, we have seen the scenario of the ISIS, how ISIS was removed from this area, we can say. This is all because of this Islamic Revolution. And if Islamic Revolution wasn't there, if these people who have raised their voice for justice, for example, the Imam Khomeini or the Supreme Leader that we call, if they were not there, we couldn't have such a we can say, like development or such an encouragement in these countries.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if I can give you some calculations, that statistics, that the Iraq was the second country in exporting the dates to the world.
That's right.
The second biggest country who was exporting dates, best dates to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the water of Farat is the best water in the world, mm-hmm. for the fertilizing.
Yes.
But obviously we know that when America went for Saddam and to like arrest him, they have destroyed all their, we can say, like the
farms
and
yes.
infrastructures and everything. And wherever America has gone, the very first thing it does is it obviously basically harms your economy.
Mm-hmm.
The things that is basis of your economy, it harms that.
Okay.
And we can see like Iraq cannot have that kind of export anymore.
That's right.
Because the trees are there, obviously they're half burned and all those things. But on top of that, we can see even although having all those things, and after that by imposing like ISIS on Iraq for the freedom, so-called freedom that they had, the Islamic land that they have, we can see how these people got courage from the Islamic Republic and how the Islamic Republic's generals, especially Qasem Soleimani,
yes.
the late martyr, yeah. Qasem Soleimani, how he has obviously paid attention and how he helped them. And
yes.
obviously he was the visitor of
yes.
the Iraqi government while he was obviously assassinated by the American regime.
Yeah.
So we can see all these things. It's because they have really raised their voice for the justice.
That's right.
And
okay.
it wasn't, although they could have taken, obviously we can see, like, even if I can give you an example from the 8-year wars of Iraq and Iran, we have seen in the life of Imam Khomeini that Imam Khomeini has many times stopped the guards of the Islamic
IRGC.
Guards, IRGC,
yes.
from invading,
yeah.
from entering the land of Iraq.
Yeah.
And he was saying, like, you have to just defend your own country.
And not killing the mass people over yes. there, that's right. Thank you, my Said Mohsen Naghvi and Brother Ali Alavian, for your
Thanks,
nice elaboration regarding the military developments of the Islamic Revolution, of the Islamic Republic of Iran after 1979 Islamic Revolution. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, visit our website, parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, also YouTube channel, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
كان وقام الإمام قام الإمام
قام الإمام
وقامت برايا وكر الأنام كر الأنام
قام الإمام
جماهير إيران في صحوة تداعت إلى الساح وسط الزحام
وقامت أسودا تلبي الخميني نداء السماء وغيث الغمام
وعاد الإمام إلى أرضه ليملأ عدلا بلاد الكرام
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.